All contributors and guests, our engineer Patsy Kullberg. Today we heard Desiree Helligers and her guests Mia Reback, Kristen Sheeran, and Michael Shannon, all working here in Oregon on climate change and the TPP issues. Bill Resnick and guest Kathleen Gershon, they looked at the women's movement and the revolution in family life. And Joe Clement and Dennis Gravy reviewed A Charlie Brown Christmas. You don't want to miss any of this, so please go to KBOO's website in a couple of days, Old Mole Variety Hour, and you'll find this show posted there. Thanks again. We'll be back next week.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And it's a minute and a half past 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland. And thank you all, KBOO members, for your generous support to keep KBOO on the air. If you are not a current member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. Next up, you know Eric Cascadia is off. We're going to hear Between the Lines. So stay tuned for that, followed by Locus Focus. Hope you're having a great day.
First, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After an initial surge, France's anti-immigrant, anti-Islamist National Front Party failed to win any of the nation's regions in the second round of elections. National Front leader Marine Le Pen led in the first round in the northern French district near Calais that is suffering with a 15% unemployment rate and is the site of a large migrant encampment. But when the socialist candidate pulled out of the final round, the vote swung to the former Conservative Party employment minister, a tactical retreat repeated in other districts that deprived the National Front of victory. Despite coming in third place in the regional elections, the National Front has made tactical gains in the run up to the 2017 French presidential election. After the election results were reported, France's socialist Prime Minister Manuel Valls declared, "Tonight there is no relief, no triumphalism, no message of victory. The danger of the far right has not been removed, far from it." In the end, the mainstream parties split control of regional governments, with former President Nicolas Sarkozy's conservative Les Républicains party winning 7 regions and the socialists 5. Paris political scientist Thomas Guénolé opined, "Everybody lost this election, especially the French voters who only cast a vote against something. There are voters who suffocated from lack of choices and alternatives offered by the mainstream parties. They want to be able to vote for something once again." Republican insurgent Ted Cruz is using a massive database of psychological profiles on millions of Facebook users to target potential voters for his conservative presidential campaign. In recent weeks, Cruz has mobilized growing numbers of Tea Party and evangelical voters, especially in Iowa. According to the Guardian newspaper, Cruz has hired little-known British data firm Cambridge Analytica to build personality profiles of potential voters using personal data without the knowledge of most Facebook users. The firm was hired with funds from Cruz's super PAC called Keep the Promise One, largely financed by hedge fund mogul Robert Mercer. The large database of Facebook likes is matched with other voter databases to identify traits such as who may own a gun. Documents obtained by The Guardian show Cambridge Analytica's London-based parent company, Strategic Communications Laboratories, was first introduced to the concept of using social media data to model human personality traits in early 2014 by Dr. Alexandra Kogan, a lecturer at Cambridge University's renowned psychology department. Kogan compiled a massive database of over 40 million people in the U.S. with detailed personality profiles. Over the last few years, conservative political campaigns, including GOP presidential candidate Ben Carson, have hired Cambridge Analytica to employ its millions of profiles to design targeted political messages on multiple platforms. Texas evangelical preacher Bob Roberts fits the profile of a conservative minister looking to spread the gospel far and wide. His spiritual journey has taken him to unusual places like Doha, Qatar, to build interfaith understanding between Christians and Muslims. Over the last 30 years, Roberts has emerged as a leading opponent of Islamophobia. Roberts, who leads a 3,000-member evangelical church outside of Dallas, has been honored by the White House for his interfaith work. The pastor told the Christian Science Monitor, "Right now the biggest challenge is in my tribe, the evangelicals." The battle for religious tolerance has only gotten tougher in the wake of the mass shooting in San Bernardino and the call by Republican frontrunner Donald Trump to ban all Muslim immigration into the United States. So it's surprising that there are a growing number of evangelical mosque partnerships emerging. In July, three Muslim charities raised $100,000 in a crowdfunding campaign to help rebuild eight black evangelical congregations in the American South that were targets of suspected arson. After a shooting incident at a military recruiting station in Chattanooga, Tennessee in July, Franklin Graham, the son of famed evangelist Billy Graham, complained on Facebook, "We are under attack from Muslims at home and abroad. We should stop immigration of all Muslims to the U.S. until this threat from Islam has been settled." Along with Muslim advocacy groups, Roberts condemned Graham's hateful post on Facebook during a press conference, stating, "Standing up for the rights of Muslims to worship impacts the rights of Christians to worship around the world." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As Venezuelans went to cast their ballots in the nation's December 6th parliamentary election, the primary issue on the minds of most voters was the failing economy, skyrocketing inflation, and severe shortages of basic goods on store shelves across the country. When ballots were counted, the ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela, founded by the late populist leader Hugo Chavez, suffered a humiliating defeat. The opposition Democratic Unity Front won 56% of the vote, while the socialists won just 41%. Under Venezuela's electoral system, the opposition now holds a two-thirds majority of seats in parliament and the power to challenge incumbent socialist president Nicolas Maduro's programs, appointments, and budget. Although U.S. politicians and corporate media have long attacked Venezuela's socialist government as a dictatorship, President Maduro, Chavez's hand-picked successor, immediately recognized the opposition's landslide victory. But in a televised address, he reminded the nation of the long history of U.S.-supported coups in Latin America, including Washington's support for the attempted overthrow of Chavez in 2002, and blamed what he called the conservative counter-revolution for sabotaging the oil-dependent economy and destabilizing his rule. Your reporter spoke with Gabriel Hetland, assistant professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino studies at the University at Albany, State University of New York, who analyzes the results of the Venezuelan election and the fate of Hugo Chavez's political legacy that he called socialism for the 21st century.
Hugo Chavez and his party won 16 out of 17 electoral contests when he was in office, and then of the 20 that have happened since he was elected in 1998, they won 18 of those. What happened in this election was that the opposition turned out very strongly, but just there was a slight increase in the opposition vote, about 4 to 5% compared to what it was in the 2013 presidential election in April. And there was a massive abstention on the part of Chavista voters, almost 2 million who stayed home compared to the turnout for the Chavista vote in that same election in April 2013. So The really big difference in turnout certainly explains the result, although there was about 400,000 voters, roughly, who switched sides. So clearly there is some defection of Chavista voters to the opposition. But I think the economic crisis that Venezuela has been facing over the last year and a half is really at the heart of the reason why some of the voters are switching and why many Chavistas were basically protesting against the government by not showing up to vote at all.
Now, a lot of voters, of course, blame the incumbent president, Nicolas Maduro, for the economic problems. But many Chavistas, people loyal to the United Socialist Party, have long thought that opposition parties aligned with the United States and other external actors were in some way responsible for at least part of Venezuela's economic problems. When you examine what economic issues are going on in Venezuela, inflation and the shortage of goods, where do you trace the problem to?
There's three things, I think, that are behind the current economic crisis. One of them is a fall in the price of oil, which has happened since about June 2014, when it was, I think, around $107, $108 a barrel. And about a week ago, at least, it was $37 a barrel. So there's been a massive fall in the price of oil, and Venezuela's budget is very dependent on oil. I think about 96% of their export earnings come from oil, and then 40 to 45% of the federal budget comes from oil. So when the price of oil drops, it's just a huge hit that the government and all the social programs and things that they've been spending money on for over a decade, they all take a hit as well. The second really important thing, and this is where the government has prime responsibility, or certainly a large degree of responsibility, is a huge gap between the official exchange rate for the bolivar, the Venezuelan currency, which is 6.3 to the dollar, and then the black market exchange rate has gotten up to over 800 to 1 to the dollar. So over 125 times, almost 150 times difference between the black market rate and the regular rate. The government's been afraid for various reasons to try to reduce that gap, which they would be able to do through a devaluation of the currency. The reason the government hasn't done that is at least partly because it would raise prices for certain goods, or at least that's the fear, that there'd be additional inflation. Some people think there's been so much inflation already that that's not a big fear, but there's questions about that. The third thing, and this is what the government's been saying, is that there's an economic war being waged against the government, against the sort of people of Venezuela by opposition sort of sympathetic business sectors that are hoping that the government will suffer, which they did in this election, if they can generate economic chaos within the country. It's somewhat difficult to find smoking gun evidence for this view. And to give you a sense of how Venezuelan people feel about it, there's been some recent polls showing that 70% of people in Venezuela didn't think that that was the main or even a primary cause of the economic crisis. And then the other 30% said, well, even if there's an economic war, the government's losing. So whether or not that's the key factor, people haven't been satisfied with the government's response to it.
With the United Socialist Party of Hugo Chavez and his successor at the helm, Nicolas Maduro, losing big time to the opposition in Venezuela, a lot of people have questions about the future of Chavez and his socialist revolution, which is credited with reducing poverty and advancing equality in Venezuela. What is your outlook for Chavez and his revolution after this defeat?
Yeah, I mean, I think they really have to acknowledge some responsibility for the economic mess the country's in. I don't think that the vote that happened on Sunday, December 6th, so about two Sundays ago, can in any way be seen as a mandate for free market capitalism. It's really about correcting the economy. I think if the government can make progress towards correcting the economy, they can certainly stay in power. I think there's millions and millions in Venezuela who want a return to the policies that were helping to reduce poverty and inequality and unemployment and raising healthcare standards and giving people pensions when they didn't have it before. They really want to return to those policies. So doing that will require better policies to fix the economic mess the country's in. I don't think the opposition has great plans in order to do that. And so if the government can make some progress on that, I think that they can stay in power and continue to do some of the things they've been doing before. If they don't make progress on that, I think it's anyone's bet in terms of what might happen. There will probably be a recall referendum against Nicolas Maduro in particular if the economy stays bad. And if the economy is not being fixed at that point, it may be the case that more Chavistas vote against the government or that they just stay home. And that could certainly create the conditions for the opposition to win a recall and then set up a new contest for the presidency.
That was Gabriel Hetland, Assistant Professor of Latin American, Caribbean, and U.S. Latino Studies at the University at Albany, New York. Find links to his recent Nation magazine article titled Why Venezuela's Ruling Party Lost Big and related analysis of the election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Are you still looking for a way to fit KBOO into your year-end giving? KBOO Community Radio is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. For the past 11 years, the Give Guide has raised nearly $13 million for hundreds of local nonprofits. Help us reach our $20,000 goal and look KBOO up on the giveguide.org website and make a donation today before December 31st. Remember, we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing donations too. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the NARA New Year's Eve Sobriety Powwow on Thursday, December 31st from 1 p.m. to midnight at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Grand entry will be at 1 and 6 p.m. with honorings, Ed Goodell as the whip man, NARA All Nations Drum as the host drum, and MC Philip Archambault. Again, that's the NARA New Year's Eve Sobriety Powwow, Thursday, December 31st, from 1 p.m. to midnight at the Oregon Convention Center, Hall A and B, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation.